Welcome one and all to our event. This event is put on by the Computer and Information Systems Department here at Cabrillo College, as well as the newly founded Cabrillo GNU plus Linux Users Group, which was founded by a student, Larry Cafieros. Say hi, Larry. It was his idea to try to get Dr. Stallman here for this evening. And as you can see, that's accomplished. The event is going to be, Dr. Stallman will speak straight through on the topic of copyright versus community. And then there'll be a question and answer period following that. So he'll be speaking roughly about an hour and a half, and then we'll have a half hour or so for questions. The restrooms, if you need to use them, are on the right-hand side as you're looking north, as you're looking that way, from the right-hand side of this building. Okay, so you have to go out and just around the corner, and those are the restrooms.
That means if you go out, you should turn left.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right.
Actually, walk all the way around.
We also have copies of the book Free Software, Free Society at the bookstore at the new Hawk Shop in the new Student Services building. If you don't pick one up today and you're local, you can stop in at the bookstore and get a copy there. As well as we have, as was mentioned earlier, we have membership cards at the tables you can pick up. So you're all here for one purpose, to hear the man that started the GNU project in 1984 and the Free Software Foundation. Perhaps more importantly, he is the leader of the free software movement. And free, we're talking about free as in freedom, not free as in free beer. So without further ado, let me introduce the brilliant social activist, Dr. Richard Stallman.
This is not a speech. Better turn this on. It might do more good that way. Is it working? Please raise your hands if you cannot hear me.
You just lost a phone.
What does this do anyway?
Probably blocks the sound.
Well, I think it does some good. Here.
Gets rid of nose snorting. Oh.
So, this is not a speech about free software, but the reason for this speech comes out of free software. You see, when the GNU plus Linux operating system became available in the 1990s and made it possible to use a computer with free software, and thus to use a computer and have freedom, it started to catch on. Some people appreciated the four freedoms, which are freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish. Freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, that's the freedom to distribute exact copies when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. Some users appreciated having these freedoms for the software that they were running. Others just appreciated it for secondary practical benefits. It was powerful and reliable, and you didn't have to pay for permission to use it, so you could save money. Various superficial side benefits. And so, for a while, people started asking me to give speeches more often about free software. At the end of these speeches, where I would explain why software ethically must be free, why the user must have these freedoms and what we were doing to bring that about. Sometimes people would ask, well, do these ideas apply to anything else? What about hardware? Should computers be free? What about cars, tables, chairs, microphones? Well, either most of those people were either misunderstanding or being wise guys. Because this definition, this particular interpretation of free, doesn't apply to physical objects. Because it means that you have the four freedoms. Well, do those make sense? Those make sense for programs because you can copy them and change them with a computer. But do they make any sense for physical objects? Like chairs, for instance? Well, freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish. For a chair, that would mean the freedom to use the chair as you wish. Well, if you buy the chair, you generally are free to use it as you wish. So you have freedom zero, always. And in general, for physical objects, you have that freedom, with occasional exceptions. What about freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish? Well, here we run into a snag. You see, there's no source code for physical objects. So we can't literally transfer freedom one to the domain of physical objects. Well, you could sort of, you could change it partly and say, well, it's the freedom to study the object and change it as you wish. Well, to the extent that that's possible, in general, you do have that freedom. You know, if you buy a chair, you're free to reupholster it. Or you could cut something off the legs or extend the legs. You know, if it's a wooden chair, there are more things you can actually do to it. A metal one, it's harder. A computer, well, at a very superficial level, you can modify it by taking out things and putting in things. But a chip, you can't modify a chip. No one can. You just destroy it. So, basically, you have freedom one as much as is feasible. But that's rather limited. What about freedom two, the freedom to copy it and distribute the copies? Well, there are no copiers for physical objects. There are no chair copiers. There are no car copiers. Now, if I owned a car, I wouldn't really mind if somebody walked up with his car copier and connected one end to my car, and out the other end appeared another identical car, and then he could, except I hope the lock would be different, and then he would pick up his car copier, get into the copy and drive it away, and I wouldn't even notice. Well, I wouldn't mind, but there are no car copiers, so only in science fiction does that issue really mean anything. And likewise, to copy and distribute copies of your modified versions. Well, yeah, there are some ways you can change a car. Some people know how to do that. But since there are no copiers, the issue of whether they can duplicate their modified car and hand out copies, it's, again, a meaningless question. So the answer is for that wise guy question is, physical objects, in most cases, are as free as they could possibly be given the limits of the physical world. And those are not anybody's fault. So that's why their question was silly. But if we move it from physical objects to another domain, there is a domain where it's a meaningful and even important question. And that is for other kinds of works of authorship that you might have a copy of in your computer. Because those you can copy and you can change. So the question of whether you're allowed to do so can make a real difference. It's a meaningful question. And that's the question that this talk is about. If you have a copy of something that's not a program, in most cases the only thing that could stop you from copying or changing it, that legally stop you, is copyright law. So, the question asked from the other direction becomes, what should copyright law say? What should copyright law allow you to do? with other kinds of works. Now, copyright, to think about this question of copyright, well, it's useful to look at the history of copyright, which is tied up with the history of copying technology. Now, changes in technology can't affect basic moral principles, because those are buried too deep. A mere change in technology just can't get down and touch them. But when we apply our principles to any specific real question, we do it by looking at the consequences of the various options available to us. So a change in the context could change the consequences of a particular act and thus make it better or worse than it was in the past. So, for instance, if we develop a technology to reliably resurrect the dead, then we wouldn't make such a fuss about murder anymore. We would say, oh, you killed him, you have to pay for his next body, and that's that. So changes in copying technology can be directly relevant to the ethical questions of copyright law. So let's look at the history of copying technology. Copying technology started in the ancient world. That's where the first was something to copy. And copying was done with a writing instrument on a surface, using the same method that you'd use to write anything else. Now, this technology had certain consequences. First of all, it required no special equipment beyond what you would use to read and write. Second, it required no other skill beyond that of knowing how to read and write. And third, it had no economy of scale. Making 10 copies would take 10 times as long as making one copy. The result of this was a decentralized system for copying. Wherever there was a copy of a book and someone wanted another, he would copy it or pay someone else to do it. As far as I can tell, there was nothing remotely like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy and you wanted to copy it, there was no law against this, unless the prince didn't like that book, in which case he might kill you for it, but that's censorship, which is closely related to copyright. But then there was a big improvement in copying technology, the printing press. The printing press made copying more efficient, but not uniformly so. Some kinds of copying became a lot more efficient, and other cases weren't affected at all. Because, you see, with the printing press, it takes a lot of time to set the type. But once you've done that, you can make many identical copies efficiently. So the printing press only makes sense if you're going to make many copies. If you're going to make one copy, it's more efficient just to write it by hand. So the result was that mass production copying became much more efficient than making one copy at a time. Now, the printing press had some other consequences. First of all, the press was an expensive piece of equipment, and the type was also expensive. So most people who knew how to read and write didn't have a printing press. And they also didn't know how to use one. It required special skills different from the skill of reading and writing. So the result of the printing press was a centralized system of production. Copies of any book were made in a few places, and then they were transported to people who wanted to buy them. For the first few centuries of printing, a substantial fraction of all copies of books were still made by hand. Typically, this was done either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or it was done by poor people because, as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So there were poor people who couldn't afford printed copies. A printed copy was cheaper than a handwritten copy would be if you paid for one, but still fairly expensive back then. So these people don't have time on their hands, time with which to make the copy themselves. Copyright began in the age of the printing press, around 1500, I believe. Now, in Italy, in the 1500s, it became normal that if you wrote a book, you could ask a prince to give you a monopoly on publishing it. And if you said nice enough things about that prince at the front of the book, he'd probably give that to you. It was the normal thing to do. Copyright in England, which was the ancestor of our copyright system, began as a system of censorship in the 1500s. So in order to publish a book, someone would have to ask the government for permission. And this permission was given to a publisher, and that publisher alone could publish it, and that was a permanent monopoly. This system of censorship became obsolete after the Glorious Revolution. And so they decided to let it lapse. But they were convinced to adopt instead a system where authors would get a copyright for 14 years. That was the Statute of Anne in the early 1700s. And the idea began to develop that copyright was meant as a system to encourage publication. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was a proposal to give authors a right to this monopoly. You'd never believe this to hear what the publishers say nowadays, but in fact that proposal was rejected. And instead, the Constitution says something else. It says that Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and inventions. This sentence tells us three important things. By the way, you know, there are many seats. You can sit down. First of all, it says that the Constitution doesn't require copyright. It doesn't say that there must be any copyright system. It only gives Congress the power to enact one. Without that, it would be unconstitutional to have copyright. Second, the purpose of copyright is to promote progress. Now, that's a benefit for the public in general. The purpose of copyright in the U.S. is not benefits for authors, let alone publishers that mainly exercise the powers nowadays. It is to benefit the general public. The aim is to have more books written, which provides us benefits such as more books we could get and read, more conversation about ideas which could help society deal with difficult issues. Thus, any privilege given to authors is not because they deserve it, but rather in the hope that this will result in benefits for the general public. And third, copyright has to last for a limited time. It can't be perpetual. Copyright in the age of the printing press operated as an industrial regulation placed on publishers and exercised by the authors for the sake of benefit to the public. Because it didn't restrict what ordinary readers could do. In fact, the original U.S. copyright law didn't cover copying, it covered printing and publication. So it explicitly didn't cover the people who still in considerable quantities made copies by hand. Because people understood it to be an industrial regulation, it was meant to restrict publishers and only publishers. Because of this, it was easy to enforce, pretty much uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced on publishers. And it's easy to find who's publishing a book. You go to a bookstore and say, where do you get these copies? You don't have to invade everybody's house or everybody's computer. It was uncontroversial because the readers, finding themselves not restricted by it, had nothing to complain about. And it was arguably beneficial because the readers, the general public, had traded away a freedom which they were not in a position to exercise. Unless you had a printing press, you were not in a position to exercise this freedom anyway, so you lost nothing by trading it away. And if in exchange you got the benefits of more books written and published, it's a good trade. If you have something worthless and you trade it to somebody for something of some value, you've benefited. And if we were still in the age of the printing press, I don't think I would be complaining about copyright law as it was then. But the age of the printing press is gradually giving way to the age of the computer networks. Another advance in copying technology that once again makes copying more efficient. And once again, it's not uniformly so. Because here's where we were in the age of the printing press, mass production and individual copying. Digital technology brings us to a situation like this. They're both more efficient, but especially one-at-a-time copying is more efficient. So we're in a situation much more like the ancient world. There's much less economy of scale now. It's not entirely gone, I'll admit. Mass-produced CDs are somewhat cheaper than one-off CDs, and they're more durable, too. But one-off CDs are feasible for hundreds of millions of people to make. So, the result is that now, just as in the ancient world, all of us who can use the copies can also copy them. The result is that copyright no longer operates as an industrial regulation. Even if the words were the same, because, you know, around 1908, the U.S. amended copyright law, so it did cover copying. It's not completely clear why, but printing presses had got a lot more efficient, and printed books had become a lot cheaper. That's when they started making paperbacks. And so even poor people could manage to afford printed copies. They didn't have to copy by hand. So why you choose the moment when people pretty much stop doing something to prohibit it, I don't know. But still, although this was done, nobody actually tried to sue the people who still occasionally made copies by hand. Because it still was expected to be an industrial regulation on publishers. But once we could all easily make copies with our computers, the same law got turned around and it became a restriction on the general public wielded by publishers in the name of the authors. As a result, it's no longer painless to enforce, no longer uncontroversial, and no longer beneficial in its current form. It's no longer easy to enforce because enforcing copyright now means enforcing it against you and me, not just against publishers. And that requires invading everybody's home and computer. It's no longer uncontroversial because we, the general reading public, no longer find it doesn't bother us. It's now being used to stop us from doing something we really want to do. And finally, it's no longer beneficial because the freedom that the government traded away on our behalf, which at the time We couldn't exercise, so we didn't mind. Now we can exercise it, so we want to keep it and exercise it. We don't want to trade it away. So, what would a democratic government would do, clearly, is say to the authors and the publishers, we're going to have to renegotiate this deal. We've been selling you some of the public's freedom, and the public now wants to keep that freedom, so we can't sell it to you anymore. We're going to have to renegotiate this deal. We're going to have to sell you less of the public's freedom. We're going to have to reduce the extent of the power that copyrights carry. We can measure the lack of democracy by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. In recent decades, copyright power has been extended as never before. First of all, this has been done in the dimension of time. Copyright lasts longer and longer. In the past few decades, the U.S. has extended the time span of copyright several times, to the point where now a copyright in some cases can last more than 150 years. The last extension was in 1998, what we call the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. This law extended by 20 years the length of copyright on both past works and future works. Now, I do not see how they could hope to convince the now dead authors of the 20s and 30s to write more works back then by extending copyright now. If they have a time machine, it doesn't seem that they have used it. Because our history books don't say that authors had a tremendous burst, and artists had a tremendous burst of activity when they discovered that in 1998 their copyrights would be extended.
No.
Well, that in itself would extend copyright because it's now based on the author's death. So if the author lives longer, copyright lasts longer too. And that's automatic even without the extension. And it's ridiculous. But anyway, so extending the copyright on past works was just a giveaway to publishers. Now, theoretically, extending the copyright on future works yet to be written could increase the incentive to write them. But any company that claims that 75 years of copyright on a work made for hire, that is a work made by employees, was not enough and that they needed 95 years, we should have challenged them to show us the projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future to back up their claim that they really needed this. Of course, they couldn't do that because no business tries to plan that far ahead, and nobody can plan anything that far ahead. No, you don't know what's going to happen. But if you could, what we do know is that the discounted value of almost anything 75 years from now is tiny. So the argument they could have made would have been completely flabby. In fact, this wasn't the reason for passing the law. This was just the excuse. As we know, the U.S. Congress sells laws for campaign contributions. The politicians don't need a reason to pass a law. They're paid to pass the law. They just need an excuse so that they don't have to admit that they were paid to pass the law. Now, one of those that paid them was Disney, because the copyright on the film Steamboat Willie was going to expire. And that was the first film where Mickey Mouse appeared. And once that copyright expires, if it ever does, other people, other artists will be allowed to draw Mickey Mouse in their works. Now, Disney has obtained a tremendous amount by using public domain material, but Disney doesn't want its work to ever fall into the public domain. So they paid for this extension. The head of the MPAA says that he wants perpetual copyright. But even with democracy as sick as it is, they can't quite get constitutional amendments through. So they can't officially get perpetual copyright. Thus, they have the plan for perpetual copyright on the installments plan. The idea is that every 20 years, they extend copyright for 20 more years. Thus, at any given time, if you point at a particular work, there's some date when it's supposed to fall into the public domain. But don't hold your breath, because by the time you get to that date, it will no longer be the date, because they will have extended copyright, and there will be another date in the future that you have to wait for, and by the time you get there, it will be extended again. It's like tomorrow, it never comes. So that's one dimension where they've extended copyright. But the other, which is even more important, is the dimension of breadth. What activities does copyright restrict? Now, traditionally, copyright was never meant to control all uses of a published work. The uses controlled by copyright were the exceptions within a broader space of unregulated use. But publishers recognized that computers would give them would make it feasible for them to take total control and institute a pay-per-read universe. And so we have seen copyright extended to cover potentially any possible use of a work. This was done also in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which essentially allowed publishers to write their own copyright rules. They can decide what's legal and they can decide what's not legal. All they have to do is implement their decision in the authorized player for the work. They release works, they publish works in encrypted formats, such that only certain authorized player programs can play them at all. And then the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says that bypassing the restrictions chosen by the publisher is a crime, and providing people with the means to do so is a crime. Distributing any other player that people can use to escape from these digital handcuffs is forbidden. Thus, for instance, there is free software that can play a DVD, but that software is censored in the U.S. The U.S. practices censorship of software. That software is censored because, in addition to using it just to watch the DVD, you could also use it to copy the DVD. So the DVDs are in fact the first widely used instance of this practice of designing works and players to restrict the users. This is known as digital restrictions management, or DRM, designing products so that they will not work. This was done by a conspiracy of companies. They worked out the details of the DVD format, and then anyone that wanted to make a DVD player had to sign a contract with this conspiracy. And the conspiracy demanded that DVD player manufacturers agree that their DVD players would restrict the public just like all the other DVD players had to. So there may be a dozen companies making DVD players, but they all restrict you the same, so there's no useful, significant competition, because this conspiracy controls it all. Now, I think that this conspiracy ought to be a crime, conspiracy to restrict the technology available to the public should be a crime. The executives who perpetrated that attack on our freedom should be in prison. But instead, with the DMCA, our government has taken their side against us, against the citizens. In fact, it's not very hard to get a copy of this free program to play a DVD. And I hope that's what you will get if you want to play DVDs. You should never buy any product with digital restrictions management unless you have the means to break the restrictions yourself. Everything else you should reject. Now, because that conspiracy was defeated in practical terms, they're still trying to set up more and more draconian laws around the world. In France, it's a crime even to possess a copy of that program. But pretty much they've lost on that one. So they have a new replacement scheme to replace the encryption of DVDs. This is called AACS, or Advanced Access Content System, or the ACS. And the ACS is what we have to give it. If you look at the rules of that conspiracy, they are incredibly arrogant. For instance, they have demanded that the manufacturers of players, after 2011, I believe it is, stop making analog video outputs. You see, they want to close the analog hole, by which the hole they're talking about is this one, this hole in your head, where your eye is. They call that a hole, and their job is to plug that. Their aim is to plug that. So, the ACS is used in things such as HD DVD discs and Blu-ray discs. And that's why we call on people to boycott those. Don't get those things. Now, in fact, AACS has been broken. About a year ago, someone released a program that had the right algorithm to decode that encryption. But that didn't do anything by itself because they didn't have the key. You need the key also. Well, someone found the key last May or so and started posting it on the net. They posted it once, it was taken down. You see, the editors of the site were afraid to have that key published because the censorship is too frightening. So other people posted it again, and then the editors took it down. It was posted again and again, hundreds of times. Eventually the editor said, all right, we give up. We can't stop people from posting this key. But people didn't stop there. I found out about it because I saw a photo of two very cute, lovable puppies, and above these puppies were 16 hex digits. I wondered, what in the world, why would anyone make this combination? I wonder if this is a key to something. These numbers must be numbers that we're not supposed to know. Eventually this number, this forbidden number, was posted on over 700,000 web pages. In a display of opposition to DRM. But don't think that DRM is lit, because of course they changed the key. I think that what that means is the discs that were made until before that point, people can read with that key, and the newer discs have some other key. So people are going to have to find it again and again and again. And of course, if you do find it, you shouldn't publish it immediately. Wait a year or so. You have to start thinking strategically. They are the enemy. We are at war with them. We have to defeat them. We have to stop them from doing what they're doing. We have to make them fail. But DRM is not limited to video. We've seen a lot of DRM in music as well. About 6 or 7 years ago, we started to see corrupt discs. At first sight, they looked like compact discs, but they weren't valid compact discs. They didn't follow the standard specifications. And in Europe, they're not allowed to call them compact. In some countries, they're not allowed to call them compact discs. They can't use the CD logo. They have to label them differently. So, I was giving a speech in Spain. I had been invited by a regional government, and I was giving the same speech. And afterwards, my host offered me a few discs with music from the region, and I wanted to listen to one. It was by a musician I was curious about. But before I opened the packet, I was fortunate to notice that it said, copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. In other words, not on free software. I wouldn't be able to read it or copy it with my computer, I think, and that means it's useless to me. In any case, on principle, I won't accept any media with DRM that I can't break. So I handed it back and I said, here you see the face of the enemy. Please return this to the store because they shouldn't be able to keep your money. I've never heard that record. It's basically corrupted. A few years ago, Sony got in a lot of hot water for its system of making corrupt discs. They designed the disc so that when you put it in your computer, it would install software into your system. The software is called a rootkit because it's similar to what crackers might use if they were trying to break into your machine and break its security. The software is installed inside the system in a place where it can interfere with things, and it also disguises its presence so that with certain commands those files don't show up. It's as if they weren't there. And it also takes steps to try to stop you from removing it. Now, this was a crime. Having this installed software in your machine without asking you this way, that's a crime. But they were not prosecuted. Not only that, but the software damages the security of your machine. Although, of course, since this was only for people running Windows, its security was laughable anyway. And not only that, but they committed copyright infringement because their program included some free software that had been released under the GNU GPL, and they were not following the conditions of the GNU GPL. Well, people did sue them. The sad thing is that although there was a lot of anger, it focused on all the incidental side issues and not on the fundamentally evil purpose of what Sony was doing, namely trying to restrict listeners. And eventually Sony settled the suit, promising that next time they try to attack your freedom, they won't do all those other nasty things. So they won't sell discs that install the rootkit. Instead, they'll build the rootkit into your machine before you get it, and it'll be impossible to remove, or at least so they hope, because what they're planning to use is AACS. That's the new scheme to handcuff us, which they hoped would not be broken. Those Sony DRM discs had one redeeming feature, though. The DRM only worked on Windows. If you played it in something else, like the GNU/Linux system, it would work just fine. And even Windows users could protect themselves if they remembered to hold down a certain key whenever they put one of those discs into the machine. What? Oh, okay. So, I'm happy to say that in the past year, there's some companies have moved to distributing music without DRM, showing that it can be done and it's not the end of the world for them. What?
MP3s, they've all gone away. People sold them.
What's all gone away?
MP3s are being sold above DRM.
Oh, good. Well, I didn't know we'd gone that far. So we're winning in one theater. But a new attack has developed in another theater, that of books. You see, the publishers of books would like to take away traditional freedoms that readers have enjoyed for centuries. Freedom to do things such as lend a book to a friend, or sell it to a used bookstore, or borrow a book from the public library, or buy a book anonymously by paying cash. And even the freedom to keep the book for many, many years, as long as you like, and read it as many times as you like, and pass it on to your children, who might themselves read it and pass it on. These things the publishers don't want us to be able to do. But their lobby is not strong enough to take away these traditional freedoms from readers, not directly. So they conceived a two-stage plan. The first stage was to take away these freedoms for e-books. That they did with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998, with only a few of us opposing it, because, you see, there were no e-books, so there were no readers of e-books, and people were not looking ahead to the freedom that they wouldn't have in the future. The second stage of the plan was to convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. And there was a big push for that 6 or 7 years ago. I know that this was organized and funded because in a domestic flight in Brazil, I accidentally pulled out the in-flight magazine, which I only do maybe once a year, and where an editorial would be in another magazine, they had an article which was speculating about precisely how long it would take before we were all reading e-books. Now, they never publish anything unless it pays them. Either it has to convince you to fly more, or they're getting paid. So I know that there was an organized PR campaign to get people to use e-books. But that, of course, didn't assure success. One publisher had the idea that the way to make their line of e-books take off was to start it with a biography of me. So they found somebody to work on writing it, and he approached me and asked if I would cooperate. Now, my life is amusing sometimes because I keep getting interesting opportunities to practice what I preach. You know, there are various things I could do to spread the word more if only I become hypocritical and ignore what I stand for in my own life. But I look at these as opportunities to translate my principles into practical action. So I said to this writer, I'll cooperate, but you've got to publish this without encryption. Well, he talked with the publisher, and the publisher wouldn't go along with it. So I said, well, why don't you try that other publisher? The other publisher accepted it, and in fact, the book was written, and they sold quite a lot of copies, and each copy has the license saying that you're free to copy it and change it. It's actually free. It gives you all the four freedoms. You can get the text on the net as well. So The first push for ebooks failed. They flopped. And I've been saying ever since they're going to try again, because I was suspicious of the number of news stories that we saw about electronic ink. I thought there's got to be a reason why this is in the news so much. I think this is probably going to be the second attempt to do away with printed books. And now we're seeing that start to happen with products like the Sony Shredder and the Amazon Swindle. So if you get those products, you are helping to establish the pay-per-read universe, where all those traditional freedoms of readers are gone. Don't do it. So we see DRM attacking us, attacking our traditional freedoms in one area after another. We have a fight on our hands. We have been trying to organize this fight with the campaign of protests against DRM that you can find in defectivebydesign.org. Visit the site, sign up, and participate in our actions. We need to make them bigger and bigger and bigger. We need to show every company, every organization that tries to do DRM that it's going to create hostility when it tries to do this. You know, public, one thing that this pay-per-read universe would do is it will turn public libraries into retail stores, retail outlets. And it's already starting to happen. A lot of public libraries in the U.S. are retail outlets for audiobooks with DRM. Now, people can buy audiobooks that are ordinary CDs, but libraries, I think, are not allowed to lend them. So what they can get is something with DRM. And they think that they are serving the public by becoming retail outlets for this. We need to teach them that is wrong. Because while they think in their short-term way that companies decide what the options are and libraries can either participate or not, the fact is, in the long term, the libraries decide what the companies can get away with. If only they had the courage to organize and stand up for our freedom and say, we are not going to accept those DRM's audiobooks. We demand that Congress change the law and allow us to lend the ordinary audiobooks. We demand to be able to lend those, then the libraries would be able to make the decision. It's only through their weakness of character that they cede the decision to businesses that want to take away our freedom. So this is what's been happening to copyright law. It has been stretched so that it's even more unjust than it would have been if it had kept the old text into the age of the computer networks. But what would a democratic government do with copyright law, given the interests of citizens and the wishes of citizens today? What it would do is it would reduce the extent of copyright power. Not get rid of it entirely, at least not necessarily. But it would say there are certain freedoms our citizens want to keep and enjoy and exercise, and we're not going to trade them away anymore. Specifically, what do I propose? Well, first, there's the dimension of time. I propose to shorten copyright so that it lasts for 10 years after publication. Now, I see no harm with allowing copyright to last for any amount of time while the work remains unpublished. If we don't have copies, we're not being restricted. You know, whether we're allowed to copy the copies we don't have doesn't make any difference. We might as well let the author have as long as it takes to find a publisher. But 10 years after that, we should be free to copy it. Now, I propose 10 years because that's considerably longer than the publication cycle. As copyright has been extended over and over, the publication cycle has got shorter and shorter. In the U.S. today, most books are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within 3. So 10 years ought to be plenty. I propose that as a first approximation. I'm not saying 10 years is the right number. I'm saying let's try that. And then we can adjust it up or down after we see the results. I once proposed this on a panel discussion with some authors. I expected fireworks, and I got them. The award-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years, no way. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I was surprised, too. I naively believed the publisher's lies when they claimed that the reason they wanted longer copyright was for the sake of the authors. The fact is that aside from the superstars, those publishers are grinding those very authors into the ground with their heels all the time. And yet they pretend that it's for their sake that they want and demand additional power over us. Why did this writer oppose copyright beyond 5 years? He was in a dispute with his publisher. His contract had a standard clause, at least it's standard in the science fiction field, that if the publisher let the book go out of print, the rights revert to him. Well, in fact, his books were out of print, but the publisher wouldn't admit it and was legally using copyright to stop him from distributing copies of his own books, which he wanted to do so that people could read them. And that's the first thing every author wants. He wants people to read what he's writing. He knew that unless he surprisingly and improbably became extremely successful, that more than 5 years of copyright wasn't going to do him any good. It was only going to enable the publishers to shaft him. So maybe we should bring it down to 5 years. But I propose 10 years because that's 3 times as long as the usual publication cycle that ought to be playing. The other dimension where we need to reduce copyright power is in breadth, what activities copyright covers. And for this, I propose to distinguish 3 broad categories of works, not based on the medium, but rather based on how they're used, what good they do for society. So one category is functional works, works you use to do a practical job. Another category is works of testimony, works whose social purposes they say what certain people think, or saw, or knew, or wanted. And a third category is works of art and entertainment, whose purpose is in the impact that they make. And according to the way they contribute to society, I propose different copyright rules for them. First, there are the works, the functional works, the works of practical use, the works you use to do a job. These include software. That might be a clue to what I'm going to say about them. But they also include recipes. And they include educational works, that you use them to do the job of learning something or teaching. and reference works that you use to look up certain information, and text fonts that you use to render text into images. All these things are used for functional purposes, and these should all be free. The reason, which applies to all these kinds of works, is if you're using the work to do things in your life, and today you find that the work is just not right for your needs, you've got to be free to change it today. And once you do, you've got to be free to publish your version, because there may be others whose needs are like yours. Once you've made it suit your needs, it may suit some other people's needs as well. You've got to be, for society to get the full benefit of use of these works, you've got to be free to publish your modified version. And that takes us to the four freedoms. So these works have to be free. People might have problems about this. They might say, but if we don't restrict all the users and how they use these works, then will they be produced at all? 20 years ago, there was room for some doubt about this. But today, we have examples such as the free software community, where we've produced many thousands of useful applications. And then there are all the recipes. In every published recipe, people do copy and change. And that didn't stop people from making those recipes and publishing them. And then in the area of reference works, we have Wikipedia and some other reference works and dictionaries that are free. Free textbooks are going along somewhat more slowly, but there are starting to be such projects. So I think we've demonstrated the feasibility of satisfying society's needs for functional works without putting chains on everybody as they use these works. So functional works have to be free. But not the works whose purpose is to say what certain people for, because to change those is simply to misrepresent those people. I don't think it is socially useful to publish an altered version of somebody else's essay of opinion or someone else's memoirs. If you have a different opinion, write your essay, your own essay, for your opinion. This category of works also includes things such as scientific papers, which, after all, they are testimony. They say, we did this, and we saw this. The person's name has to be there. It's crucial. It's not just somebody says he did this and saw this. He says he did this and saw this. And if he's lying, his reputation gets it. If there's a possible mistake, he'll have to defend it, or else acknowledge that the paper is wrong. Who the author is crucial to these works. So, since there's no reason why people should be free to publish modified versions of these works, it's also feasible to say that all commercial use is covered by copyright. So we can have a compromised copyright system where everybody is free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of the work, but commercial use and modification are covered by copyright as today. Thus, this compromised copyright system would provide revenue to the authors or artists, more or less as today. Of course, it's usually inadequate today, so it'll usually be inadequate after this change, but that's okay. That's not making it much worse. And so it would support to the more or less to the same extent, or almost the same extent, the production of these works. Of course, a lot of these works are not supported. The authors are not getting any support from today's system. The authors of scientific papers don't get paid. They still do it. They have other reasons why they want to publish their papers. Anyway, there's the third category, the category of works of art and entertainment. For this category, it took me years to resolve to my own satisfaction the issue of modification. Because there are valid arguments, I think, on both sides of allowing people to make publish modified versions of artistic works. On one side, there's the argument that the work may have an artistic integrity that modifying it could destroy. And I think that is true some of the time, even though most writers don't seem to have much integrity to judge. By the way, what's happening with the cameras? Is it time to change the film? Oh, okay, so we have two cameras. Should I wait?
I'll give you time in a few minutes.
Okay. When you look at how they allow Hollywood to butcher their works for a lot of money, you can see that most authors don't really have that much integrity. But a few of them do. There are a few who won't let Hollywood butcher their works. But on the other hand, there are a lot of arguments in favor of allowing modification of artistic works. Consider, for instance, the folk process, where a series of people transform a work and can produce something very rich. But if we want to consider only named authors, consider Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays borrowed stories from other works that had been published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect, those plays would have been illegal and they would not have been staged or published. They probably would not have been written. And if anyone had ever complained about this, the copyright holders would have said, Shakespeare just wants to make a cheap ripoff of my wonderful work. If he's really talented, why doesn't he make his own story? Why should he use mine? And since we would never see the work that Shakespeare might have written, we would have no basis to say that was not true. But since, in fact, there wasn't today's copyright law, and those works were produced, and were written, were staged, were published, we can say that they're great literature. But we can only say that because we did get to see them. So, with valid arguments on both sides, I wasn't sure what to say about modification of these works. And then I realized that although modifying artistic works can be a contribution to art, it's not desperately urgent. It's not like modifying the program that you use or the recipe that you use, which isn't working well for you. You've got to be free to do that today. But with modifying published artistic works, you could wait 10 years for the copyright to expire. So it's okay to have the compromised copyright system for the 10 years that the copyright lasts. And during that time, everyone would be free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies, but other uses would require permission. And then when the copyright expires, everybody could publish their modified versions. I think this compromise would work out okay. So, this is what I propose, and one consequence... Oh, it's time to change it now.
Right.
Okay. I couldn't hear you. I just heard a mumble, and I didn't know who it was about.
Can you get some more water there?
Yeah, it would be nice to have some more tea. Oh, there is more water here.
Water,
yeah, just pop. No, we have to plug it in. You see, there's no switch. I had to take it out because that was the only way to stop it from just wastefully using the electricity.
Turn all the way out the water.
Why make it slower?
keep them free fair.
So one consequent, wait, someone said okay, but so one consequence is that sharing music on the internet should be legalized. Of course, the record companies say, but that's horrible, that means that you won't support the musicians. Well, when I buy commercial CDs, I'm ashamed because I know I'm not supporting the musicians. The fact is that when you for most of these CDs in the store, if you buy it, the amount the musician will get is zero. Not just small, zero. You see, there's a certain part of the price that supposedly is the share for the musicians, but they never get it because it just goes from one account in the record company to another. The production and publicity expenses are designated as an advance to the musicians. And so their share of the CD price only goes to repay that. It's very rare that any record sells enough copies to finish repaying that and actually start giving money to the musicians when people buy copies. Normally what happens is that it just never gets there. Records can go gold, I think even platinum, and not reach the point where the musicians get any money when you buy one. Now, this is not to say that the musicians get no benefit from their record contracts, because they do get other benefits from the publicity that's done. You know, they get more concerts, more people come to their concerts, and they can sell stuff at their concerts. And this way they actually make some money. So the publicity is useful, but there are other ways to give musicians publicity, like mailing a copy to your friend of a song that you like. We don't have to let the record companies with their music industrial complex control publicity for music, for so-called music which is made after all, it's the music industry, that implies it's factories. So they're making music in factories. They bring in these carloads of money and they press it into something that looks like music, but when you bite into it, you see it's really just hype. So I'd like to see the end of the music factories. I think it would be an improvement if we had only music made by artisans and had no more music factories at all. Now, the major record companies pay 4% of their income to musicians. That's the figure I saw some years ago. But that's not uniform. It's not as if each musician gets 4% of the sales of their records. No, the superstars get more than 4% of their large sales figures, and the other musicians get much less than 4% of their small sales figures. So it's a really lousy system for supporting music. And we already know that music sharing on the internet doesn't actually lead to any decrease in their income. So we should just legalize it. There's no reason not to. But, you know, we might want to have a system which works better to support music than the current system, which is lousy. And I have two proposals for how to support music better, and other kinds of art as well. One is with a tax on either blank discs or internet connectivity or whatever, or packets transferred or whatever. And then the money would be used to support the arts. And here's how I propose to use it. Give it entirely to the people who participated creatively in making the work. And to do it based on their popularity, but not in linear proportion, and that's crucial. There are countries that have a system somewhat like this, but they do it in linear proportion. The problem is that that way most of the money goes to superstars that don't need the help, and that leaves very little to go to everybody else, which means it's fairly ineffective at supporting all the rest of the artists who really need it. So I propose instead that we use something like the cube root or fourth root of somebody's popularity. What does that mean? Well, suppose we take the cube root. Well, so imagine there's a superstar who's 1,000 times as popular as some other fairly successful artist. Well, with linear proportion, the superstar would get 1,000 times the share, which means most of the money would go to a few superstars. But with the cube root, that means the superstar would only get 10 times the share. Cube root of 1,000 is 10. Well, if the superstar gets only 10 times as much as an ordinary successful musician, that means most of the money will be going to a lot of different musicians. And the superstars, even though each one gets more, since there are fewer, much fewer of them, they will, the total share that goes to superstars will be much less than half. Meaning a lot of the money goes to support everybody else. This way the money can be used much more efficiently than our 4% of what we pay to the record companies gets used now.
Can we apply that to CEOs as well?
Maybe so, but it's a different issue because I'm talking about a tax, and the government would decide how to distribute the tax money. That's not comparable to what happens in a company with a CEO. That isn't a matter of distributing tax money. But I have another proposal which doesn't involve taxes, and that is voluntary payments. And this, like the other one, could be extended to other arts as well. The idea is that every player should have a button that says, send a dollar. And the idea is, if you feel like sending a dollar, you push that button and it sends a dollar to the people who participated creatively in making that work that you just looked at or are looking at. And you can do this as much as you want to. But I think people will do it fairly often. Except for poor people, of course. They won't. They can't afford to, and that's fine. There's no need for artists to get their support from poor people, because there are enough people who aren't poor. I think that most of us, if we pushed that button once a week, we wouldn't notice the $50 a year that we would be sending to various musicians and artists. I think that we would be happy doing that. I think we would support the arts better this way, with the exception of the superstars and the blockbusters. And I wouldn't miss those. And I think that it would make the arts healthier. And if we weren't happy with the frequency with which people push these buttons, then we could have a public relations campaign urging people to push the button more. Saying, and so instead of nasty, vicious propaganda saying, sharing is theft, don't ever help anybody else, don't be a good friend, divide society, be isolated, be alienated. We could have a friendly PR campaign. Have you sent a dollar to a band this week? It's only a dollar, and don't you love the music? Send a dollar. And this goes with human nature. Instead of telling people that they should be mean and nasty and sounding mean and nasty, it's warm and kind. It inspires people to be warm and kind. Thank you. Now, sometimes people worry whether movies could possibly be supported using the system I've proposed. I think they can be. The reason people doubt this is they've heard gigantic figures for how much it costs to make a movie. But those figures are inflated twice. First of all, more than half is advertising cost. Actually, making the movie is the smaller part of it. Second, that amount's already inflated by the studio because, you see, if the movie makes money beyond that point, then they have to start paying it out to the investors. So, if they can inflate the costs, they get to keep the money in the studio. So it's creative accounting. Now, that's one side of it. The other side is a lot of the use of movies is commercial use, which would be covered by the compromised copyright system, and so they'd get paid for it just as now. Consider showing movies in theaters. That's commercial use. Showing them on airplanes. Showing them on TV. It's all commercial use. So they get a fraction of the money coming in, but that's enough to cover actually making the movie if they didn't exaggerate. And instead of making movies that focus on special effects, they could make movies that focus on stories about people. And they might even be better. Now, we all know that Hollywood usually produces crap. This is not because somebody is incompetent. It's because they're aiming to make crap. Systematic reasons go into this. I read a book called Save the Cat, whose purpose is to teach people how to write screenplays that will sell. But what I got out of it was the systematic reasons why Hollywood movies are crap. Because that's the criteria for buying a screenplay. Now, I don't believe in censorship, and I'm not saying that we should stop people from making crappy movies. You know, if he wants to make a crappy movie and she wants to watch it, well, okay. Far be it from me to say that they can't do it. But the question is, should we give up our freedom to help them keep making crap? And that's where I think we should say no. Now, the special effects will get a lot cheaper, I'm sure. I mean, right now they probably still use fancy, expensive computers and lots of special purpose programming, but 10 or 20 years from now, that probably won't be so expensive. And so all the movies might be much, much cheaper to make. Who knows? I think we can't assume that. But for now, I think that they will get by with the revenues from the compromised copyright system, which in the case of movies would still be a large fraction. And then, of course, we could also have the send a dollar scheme. If a lot of people watch movies, a lot of people will send a dollar. If they feel respect for the people who made the movie because they see the people who made the movie respected them. So that's my talk. I do hope you'll buy some of the shirts and books so that we don't have to send them back to Boston. And you'll be supporting the free software movement that way. But first, let me answer questions.